Colonel Wilkerson, welcome back to India and Global Left.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
We have been covering U.S. escalation on Venezuela on this channel from various angles. There's been a full-blown escalation on the Caribbean from Puerto Rico, where this so-called war on narco-terrorism has been launched. Over and above that, there are huge buildups of U.S. military assets in the Caribbean, including the coast of Venezuela, including attack operations. And it must be mentioned about the escalation of propaganda war, including the Nobel Peace Prize. And Maria Corina Machado has been promising all kinds of Venezuelan assets to U.S. corporations. Obviously, Trump has indicated that he wants a regime change. There is no doubt about it. But the question is, how far would the U.S. go to attempt that regime change? I wonder what your thoughts are about the current U.S. strategy on Venezuela.
My thoughts go back to the Bush administration that I served, George W. Bush, from 2001 to 2005. And some of the things that we did there that I'm seeing repeated, only with more profundity, more depth, more breadth, and more illegality. And I mean that in both a domestic and an international sense. Start at the very top and talk about what the Nuremberg trials, which we're now celebrating, what the 80th anniversary of, and the major decision there was encapsulated in something Justice Jackson wrote. And it went something like, the purpose is to stop wars of aggression. The whole purpose of the process, the American purpose. Others sided with that purpose during the course of the tribunal, but some did, as the Soviet Union, I would say, did for reasons of expediting what they needed to get done, because like the British, who wanted to take all the war crimes home, all the war criminals home and shoot them, the Russians wanted to take, the Soviets wanted to take them all to Moscow and try them in show trials and then shoot them. So when Jackson did that, when he ground the real purpose of the tribunals down to wars of aggression, his opinion, and I think it was right, and this was what the UN was then later built on, was that that was the kernel of all murderous war in the world. Aggression. And so that's what the tribunal tried to at least leave some voices. And then later in 48, we had the first, second, third, and fourth Geneva Conventions and other attempts to make war, I won't say more palatable, but to make war at least more reasonable, if nothing else, and to have some rules and to have some laws and hopefully some very strident laws. The other thing that the tribunal did was establish the precedent of international criminal justice and international criminal law. We are now destroying that. Peg by peg, thread by thread, we are unweaving, if you will, the entire fabric that began in 1945, continued in 48, and continued in the years following as we tried to develop the UN and to develop the rationale for the UN. Now we are the biggest culprit on the face of the earth for wars of aggression. We are trying to essentially conduct a war of aggression against Venezuela. We're already there with the CIA. We've been there since 2016 when Donald Trump signed a presidential finding for Mike Pompeo, then the head of the CIA, to begin a war on the ground in Afghanistan or in Venezuela. So I get tongue-tied at all the wars that we have. So you can't even say that this is new, because it began in Trump's first administration with a very violent direct action in Venezuela conducted by special operating forces and the CIA.
Is there any way to predict how far the Trump administration would go? I mean, there are speculations about Tomahawk firing. There are also talks about actual invasion. There are a lot of noise about Gerald Ford, the largest aircraft carrier, taking to the region. What is your intuition about whether the propaganda device propped up by the Trump administration, whether they would be limited to that, or they would go whole hog and take a military intervention? Given I want to mention that scholars from Latin America are saying that this kind of escalation about U.S. intervention is even dividing the Venezuelan opposition, and a section of the opposition which were earlier supporting sanctions, thinking that that would topple Maduro's government, are now turning against U.S. escalation because they're against U.S. military intervention in their own country. So I wonder, is there a way to predict if the Trump administration would take the military course all the way?
That latter point you made, I think, is true. And let me back up and give a little bit more explication of what's happening there. I'm 90% sure of this because I have some contacts still that will talk to me. What has been going on has been a joint operation, maybe even more than a joint operation in terms of a third or a fourth party. But there are certainly two parties in this. One, of course, is the empire, the United States. But the other, very substantively, is Israel. Israel is there big time. Israel has been there since the first finding in the 2016 year of Trump's first administration. Israel is a part of the intelligence picture, whether it's false, fair, accurate, or whatever. And in most cases, I think it's pretty false. And Israel is a manipulator of the intelligence that Trump is getting. One of the people giving Trump the intelligence is an Israeli citizen, dual citizen, of course, which is what we like to have in this country. But he's an Israeli citizen. He's linked with a former CIA individual who are giving for money Laura Loomer intelligence from Venezuela that they say is accurate, and Trump is turning his face away from the vested intelligence community, starting with Tulsi Gabbard and others, and listening to Laura Loomer. So he's getting his intelligence about Trinidadagua, about drugs and so forth, from a source that's being paid by certain members of the opposition in Venezuela to give him that intelligence. You can't make this up. Israel is a big part of that. And the person who's working with the CIA operative is an Israeli citizen, as I said. You got the Nobel Peace Prize winner, as you said, Machado, who is plugged into it too. I won't go this far, but I will at least surmise that she might be a Mossad asset. So you have all of this going on. And then to come to your question, is any of this really going to overthrow Nicolas Maduro and the government he represents? I don't think so. And I think it's going to be a real disaster if we try to use major force, force majeure, to do it. Whether we sneak up on it or we frontally assault it, it makes no difference. We're going to get our hands tied in a mess. Think Vietnam, think Afghanistan, think any of the wars that we've been involved. Think Somalia, for example, when we went in supposedly to do humanitarian good and wound up chasing warlord Mohamed Farah Adid and had to withdraw ignominiously from Mogadishu. That's what we're looking at. And this president doesn't seem to have a grasp of this sort of thing.
It is known to almost everyone in Venezuela that while there is a debate about the sanctions when it comes to military intervention, the Lopezes and Guaidos and the Machados are all people who live in Florida or other parts of the United States and not real people living in Venezuela. And I also wanted to add that, as you indicated, that there seems to be division within the military and the intelligence, probably within the military, people who know the reality of Venezuela and those who the partisan hacks and, you know, those all the on the payrolls of Mossad and so on. I think the fact is that in Venezuela, the military is extremely politicized. And this is a distinction between, for instance, Chile in 1973, where Allende Salvador didn't go after the military to replace with his own people, which is not the case in Venezuela. So in Venezuela, the military is extremely hooked into the whole Bolivarian process, meaning thereby that any kind of attempt of coup is extremely difficult in Venezuela. And one might disbelieve numbers of millions of militias being recruited. Those 7 million, 8 million might be overstated, I don't know. But it is true that there is a popular consensus, unanimous consensus in Venezuela against U.S. military intervention.
Yes, I'm a student of the Chilean episode with Nixon and Kissinger, and I can tell you it's quite different. The Chilean military was really on our side throughout all those years because we had bought them, essentially. And they knew because we had bought them, if it were a coup that was successful, they would be in charge. And so all they did was fight over who the general would be that would be in charge. A little bit different situation here. We have not been through the school of America, of the Americas or whatever. We have not been up close and personal with the Venezuelan military in any way other than maybe some CIA infiltration and trying to bribe people. That could have happened. I suspect it has. But I don't think they've been very successful in that effort because the military has basically been loyal. So this would be an entirely different operation. You would probably have the bulk of the military, the Venezuelan military, against you from the get-go. That's a very different situation than buying the military out and having them, even as they did in Chile, turn on Allende and produce who they produced, which was not too good for Chile. So I think what we're looking at is a true guerrilla war that we'll lose. And while I would love to see us lose in a situation like that yet again and try to teach us a lesson in terms of those kinds of things, I don't want to see that pain brought on Venezuela or on Colombia or Nigeria or anywhere else, especially not when it's not called for. They are not threats. Here's the fundamental thing. They are not threats to the national security of the United States. Trump and his Justice Department and his Defense Department leap through hoops every day with the Speaker of the House and the leader of the Senate orchestrating their leaps and being very, very supportive of them to substantiate that what they're doing is in the name of the national security of the empire, which is preposterous. Even with Iran, it's preposterous. Iran presents no threat of significance to the empire, unless the empire wants to sit in the middle of the Persian Gulf and wave a flag, which President Ahmadinejad once said to me in New York. Let me see if I've got this right now. Iran owns about 1,875 kilometers of Persian Gulf coastline, and the United States owns how many kilometers? His point, very vivid point, the threat in the Persian Gulf was not from Iran. The threat was from the United States of America. And everybody in the region knew that, even the Saudis and the Emiratis and others. So there is no threat to the national security of the United States from any of these targets that Trump is looking at, with the possible exception of China. And, you know, what are we doing there? That's another issue altogether, but it's a big issue. It's a huge issue. It's a nuclear issue.
I want to actually come to China, but just a side comment on the threat. It reminded me of some of these debates in the 80s about U.S. generals saying that Nicaragua and possibly even Cuba are posing great threats to the United States. And in one of these debates, Noam Chomsky said that it would be a disservice to even Hitler, saying that his narrative that Czechoslovakia was a threat to Germany would be similar to the threat caused by Cuba or Nicaragua to the United States. I mean, even Hitler might have some point when he made a statement about Czechoslovakia. I mean, such is the absurdity of U.S. inventing threats from these small nations. But I think I wanted to discuss China, particularly maybe in the context of Latin America, given one of the reasons why Trump and his ilk, of course, the Secretary of War, who wants to keep doing war to keep his position and job, but Marco Rubio, it's just someone on steroids, just going on and on. There is a huge China factor, given the economic ties and relationships with a whole range of Latin American nations, Brazil, Venezuela, even Panama, even Mexico, which is the largest partner, economic partner of the United States. These are China, Latin American nations' economic ties are rapidly increasing. And we have been discussing, you have spoken on our show about the U.S. empire having to wrap up its empire and become a nation state again. And given the recent loss the U.S. faced against China, I mean, it was very confident when it launched its economic warfare and it had an humiliating defeat. What do you think is the grand strategy of the United States when it comes to China going forward? Is there any reset in thinking of the Stephen Miller's and you know, the Manhattan Foundation and all these China hawks? Is there any rethinking and resetting given the humiliating loss they faced recently, or are they continuing down the same path, even designing a nuclear war with China?
I can detect no strategy, none whatsoever. I detect a menagerie of people who think they have a strategy and who can express that strategy from time to time in terms that are almost indecipherable. Steve Bannon comes to mind immediately, and even Pete Hegseth. But I don't detect any grand strategy, nor do I detect a strategy vis-a-vis a block of countries or a single country like China. No strategy whatsoever. And back to your point about China, everywhere virtually that China is making inroads, they are doing so because we have screwed it up so badly that people are begging China to take over. That's how awful it is, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. Brazil is a perfect case. China is moving in where it detects weakness and mistakes by the empire, and they are making great headway doing that. You don't even have to quote Sun Tzu. It's not an indirect strategy. It's a strategy of, look there, my major enemy is making gross error after error after error, and I'm flowing into those errors and giving the people some alternatives. That's what's really happening. And it's a sad, sad commentary, because I don't think this administration understands that's what's happening to them. I don't think Donald Trump understands that Xi Jinping handed him his rear end in the last meeting they had in China. Handed him his rear end, as in beat him to a pulp. So he comes out and announces that it was a great meeting. I'm sure Xi Jinping thought it was one of the best meetings he'd ever had. Although these people like Putin and Xi Jinping and even Modi and certainly Lula have to wonder, and I think there are a few people in Europe who might be leaders of the future, replacing Starmer, Macron, and all the rest of the idiots over there who detect this too, that what I'm saying is in fact happening. And they're trying to decide, do I want to go whole hog with China? Do I want to be independent? Do I want to be 50-50? What do I want to do? Because I don't want to sell my soul to anybody, even China, but I can't depend on the empire anymore. In fact, I have to fear the empire now. That's what people are thinking around the world. And as I said, increasingly they're thinking that in NATO, not in the current governments, but in the ones that are going to replace the current governments, which, mark my words, will happen in the next 18 months. Every government will be replaced in Europe. It'll start with France, England, and Germany, but it'll roll like an avalanche over the rest of Europe as they realize 5% of GDP? Are you kidding me? Where's my social programs? Where's my agricultural programs? Where's my free education? Where's my free health care? All those sorts of things. These leaders aren't going to hang around. And that's worrisome because I wonder what Europe's going to do when it really hits. Are they going to go back to the Europe of the 30s, or are they going to form some sort of European security architecture to start with? And is it going to include Russia, for example, as we had contemplated at the end of the Cold War with George H.W. Bush? I would say that's going to be very difficult given what Russia has seen NATO do to it in the past, you know, since 2014, certainly, and even before that. I was just reading a report on the Nazis in Ukraine. Holy mackerel. I mean, they're all over the place. Putin has not eradicated them yet. He's pushed them all up into the remaining sector of Ukraine. And they're all around Zelensky. And Zelensky can't move without these people. He can't move. He can't do anything without them. They'll blow his brains out the moment he decides he wants to do something not in their plans. And there's quite a few of them. I always thought, when I was working with Ukraine back in the early 2000s as chief of staff of the State Department, our intelligence was telling us maybe 150,000, maybe somewhere between 100 and 150,000 true Nazis. I'm talking about Bandera's boys. What I saw the other day of the list comes from our own intelligence community, and it's well over 200,000. So this is a pretty formidable force, and they've been husbanding themselves. They've not been going to the front lines to do battle because they know if they do, they'll get killed. So they're staying back in the rear and husbanding their force so they will be the ultimate power in Ukraine, whatever results from the war. And if they are the ultimate power, there will be no peace. There will be no peace. We may have a cessation of hostilities, if you will, but there will be no peace, not as long as these people are there, because they are Nazis, and their motto and their beliefs are Nazi-like. So disaster looming there, too, but I think there's another place where Trump hasn't a clue. He has people talking to him, people briefing him, that are telling him the untruth about Ukraine and about the situation in Ukraine. No matter whether he wants to go more forcefully in support of Zelensky, he wants to be neutral, or he wants to completely back off, he does not know the truth about Ukraine. And he's the only one, the empire is the only one, sad to say, that really has still the remaining oomph and contact and wherewithal in terms of the Europeans to shut this down. And he's not doing it. So there's no strategy.
But what kind of lies is he being told regarding Ukraine, that NATO can still hold on to this war, that Ukraine can still keep pushing the Russians? Are these the kind of lies? What are the kind of lies he is hearing? There is a point in time before the summit, I'm talking about President Putin and President Trump's summit, the Alaska summit, where Trump started echoing the reality when he was talking about Ukraine, loss of Ukrainian forces, the movement of the front, the direction of movement of the front lines, et cetera, et cetera. And recently he has stopped talking anything about it. So what kind of lies are being told to him?
Mostly Lindsey Graham and his crew, who are telling him, it doesn't matter. What you're doing is you're bleeding Russia, and you want to bleed them to the last drop of blood. And if it costs Zelensky his life, if it costs Ukraine another 100 kilometers of terrain, so be it. You want to bleed Putin to the maximum. And Graham's even telling him that if he does that, in the middle of that, Putin will fall. That's what he's telling him, that Putin is hard pressed. Even when someone comes over that knows what he's talking about and tells the president, as one individual did, I'm told, that Putin is hard-pressed, all right, but he's hard-pressed by the right. They want him to finish this war. If necessary, destroy Ukraine. not hard pressed by peaceniks or people who want it to stop. But Trump is not getting the right view. And Graham has, I don't know what kind of hold Graham has on Trump, because really the two men despise one another. It works both ways. They despise one another. But Graham has some kind of hold on him, and it might not just be Graham as Graham. It might be the entourage that Graham leads in the Senate and elsewhere. But they do not want to give Putin a moment's rest. They fear if we give him a moment's rest, he will revive, and they know he's dying. That's what they're telling Trump.
I was following the U.S. escalation on India when those additional sanctions were imposed, and I saw that Lindsey Graham had a tremendous leverage. I mean, I didn't have any direct evidence, but the kind of things Lindsey Graham was saying about restrictions on H-1B, about additional sanctions on India because of buying Russian crude oil for refinery, et cetera, all of them manifested, or even ultimately Peter Navarro and others started towing the same line and started spilling them in Fox News. And that became the U.S. policy. I mean, long before it was even spoken within the officials in the Trump administration, it was Lindsey Graham and his ilk who was making noises about those kind of policies. So it's not surprising when you were saying that Lindsey Graham must be having some kind of leverage over Trump, despite the two guys hating each other.
I'm being told,
yes.
I'm being told, and when I was first told this, I just tossed it aside, but now I'm having difficulty doing that, that it's somehow wrapped up with the Epstein affair, that so many people have so many holds on other people because of the Epstein affairs. And so a lot of what we're looking at is kind of opaque. You wonder why this happened. You wonder why that happened. And it goes back to years and years of a lot of participation with Epstein in these people's lives. And it's not just the Lolita Express. It's not just, you know, pedophiles and so forth. That's some of it. But a lot of it is the money he wielded and the influence through that money he wielded and the nefarious things that people did with that money. For example, I'm told that Ehud Barak was as participatory in the island process as was Prince Andrew. And we've seen what happened to Prince Andrew. And that doesn't happen very often unless there's some fire there. You know, a lot of smoke, a lot of royal smoke, but there was some fire there. I'm told Barak was as participatory as Prince Andrew was. And there are emails to corroborate that. I'm told Bill Clinton was almost the same. And I go back to Oslo and that moment of sudden stoppage, and Arafat caught in the headlights like a deer and wondering what had happened to him. And everything ended, stopped. And I'm being told by people who know what they're talking about normally that there was a little blackmail going on there with both Clinton and Barack. So if those kinds of things have any shred of truth to them, then a lot of what the question you ask about Graham and where's this power coming from has an origin, I think. There are a lot of people blackmailing a lot of people. And Lindsey Graham's not necessarily out of that either, because Lindsey is known to have some problems himself. I won't go into them, but he has some problems. When he says he doesn't have time for sex, he's too busy, there are reasons for that.
We'll be right back. say, oh, 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 oh.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The dimensions of Hazrat Fatima's personality, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, February 19th, 2018. Lady Fatima alayha salam. She was an exemplary woman who, although lived a short time and departed earth as a young lady, is a role model for all zealous, devout Muslim men and women, and even non-Muslim people who are familiar with her prestigious position. We should follow Fatima's lead. During the life of Fatima alayha salam, there is one point that we should consider. Here, we will not question the degree of her spiritual position and knowledge. We're not even capable of comprehending the spiritual greatness of Fatima alayha salam. In fact, at the top of human spirituality and perfection, only God knows and understands the high level of such individuals and others at their level. Thus, Fatima alayha salam is only known to her husband, her great father Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, and her pure children. The people of her time, of other times, and we in this era are not able to recognize the brilliance and splendor of her spirituality. The bright light of spirituality is not detectable by everybody's eyes. Our short-sighted and weak eyes are unable to see the luminosity of humanity in these great personalities. Therefore, we do not discuss the definition of Lady Fatima's spirituality. However, in her ordinary life, there is an important point. On the one hand, as a Muslim woman, she perfectly performs her duties at home and behaves nicely towards her husband and children. On the other hand, as a zealous, tireless person, she acts for her causes. In political events, shortly after the death of her father, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, she went to the mosque, gave a speech, expressed her position, and defended her cause. Hence, she represented a marvelous fighting personality that is tireless, enduring, and tolerant. The third aspect of her life reveals her as a devotee of Allah. who performs prayers in the dark of nights, uprises for Allah, and is humble before Allah. And in the worshipping chamber, this young lady worships and speaks to God like the old pious people. Combining these three dimensions is the luminous point in the life of Fatima alayha salam. She did not separate the three dimensions. Some people think that those who worship God are only concerned with prayers and worship and cannot be involved in politics. Or some people think that those women and men who are active in politics and the arena of jihad on the path of Allah, if a woman, she cannot perform her duties at home as a mother and a wife. And as a man, he cannot be a good businessman, husband, or father. They think these qualities are contradictory. Whereas in the view of Islam, these aspects not only reveal that there are no contradictions, but they are also helpful towards achieving the perfect human personality.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The International Federation for Human Rights, one of the oldest human rights organizations in the world, says from Paris to Washington, Berlin to London, support for Palestinian rights has been censored, criminalized, or violently repressed under the pretext of combating anti-Semitism and protecting national security. In a recent report, the FIDH focused on violations of the rights to freedom of assembly, association, and expression in the content of the repression of Palestinian solidarity movement in France, Germany, the UK, and the US. Now, today, there is a court session underway, in the United Kingdom as leaders of Palestine Action fight to have their group delisted as a terrorist organization, while in Germany, a similar group, Palestine Congress, is also seeking answers from a Berlin court why police, they feel, unlawfully shut down their April conference. This disturbing Western trend of authorities targeting Palestinian activism to protect apartheid, occupation, and genocide is a topic of our Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us is Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator at Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Beirut, Lebanon. And Mr. Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist and organizer, joining us from Texas, out of the States. Hello to our esteemed colleagues and guests, Charlotte Cates and Mohsen Naqvi. Welcome to the program. I guess we'll start with Charlotte in Beirut. Charlotte, good to talk to you again, have you join us. your initial take on this campaign by Israel's enablers and suppliers in the West to try to censor and put an end to any kind of criticism of Tel Aviv's long list of war crimes and crimes against humanity when it comes to Palestinians?
Well, when we look at the ongoing genocide, which is still taking place in Gaza, but is also and has been being carried out against the Palestinian people as a whole for the past 78 years, what we see is that the imperialist powers, Britain, the United States, France, Germany, Canada, Italy, are partners in crime. And in fact, they view the maintenance and creation of the Zionist entity as a way of achieving their goals to dominate and control and oppress the entire region. And what we've seen after Al-Aqsa flood, after the uprising of the Palestinian people, as millions of people poured into the streets in support of Palestine and an absolute outrage and horror against the Zionist genocide, which revealed to the world the reality of Zionism and revealed to the reality, revealed to the world the reality of what those billions of dollars in weaponry and funding and support going to the Zionist entity actually mean, that they do in fact mean dead children and murdered families and destroyed hospitals and universities and schools, it became absolutely unacceptable to the imperialist powers that people domestically were speaking out, rising up, and organizing. And so you see things taking place like mass criminalization of organizing for Palestine, police attacks, the designation of Sami Doun as a terrorist entity by Canada, the designation of Palestine Action as a proscribed organization by Britain. Right now, there are six activists on hunger strike inside British jails because they've been held for a year. They're being subjected to censorship, and the British government is continuing its complicity in genocide. So they are protecting their interests because they view the maintenance of this genocidal regime as a goal for preserving their hegemony.
Thank you for your opening take there, Charlotte. Mohsen Naqvi, pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for your patience. Now, Mohsen, your opening thoughts as well. This organization, the International Federation for Human Rights, they say the British government has repeatedly minimized and legitimized Israel's atrocities in Gaza, carried out a sustained attack on the right to protest. Protests in solidarity with Gaza and against Israel's genocidal violence has been met with high levels of police surveillance and police violence. And case in point, as Charlotte was just referring to, Palestine Action supporters, thousands arrested, hundreds charged, many still detained, some of them on hunger strike. Your initial take, please.
Well, yeah, the British government has made its priorities very, very clear. Shielding Israel from accountability matters more than protecting its own population's basic democratic rights. We've seen a sustained attack on the right to protest, especially in the West. And mass marches against the slaughter in Gaza have faced intense surveillance, aggressive policies, and now the criminalization of direct action groups like Palestine Action, even to the point of proscribing them as terrorist organizations. That move, it has opened the door to thousands of arrests and hundreds of charges against supporters all over the world, from people taking action against arms factories to those simply holding signs or even wearing symbols of solidarity for Palestine Action. And when a state, when a country, when an empire responds to peaceful or civil disobedience protests with terrorism laws, historically it is admitting something it cannot morally defend its position. So it leans on repression, not persuasion. And that's exactly what we're seeing here in the UK. It is a government more interested in protecting Israeli arms deals than protecting its own people's right to oppose a genocide.
And that's a very good point. And Charlotte, that's going to bring me to my next question. I mean, these charges and this harassment of from the college campus protests, harassment of students, many of them that weren't American citizens, arrested and deported because of pro-Palestine activities, the demonstrations and demonstrators in the UK, in Germany, all the way to Australia, France, arrested and charged. Many people have their livelihoods uprooted as a result of the pro-Palestine activism. Now, these are, you know, taking place in direct contravention of the constitutional liberties and guarantees these people are supposed to enjoy in these Western societies. They're supposed to have the platform and the freedom to speak out against Israel and its atrocities against Palestinians.
Well, let's just say this. Over the past 2 years, any kind of illusion about what Western states mean when they speak about human rights and democracy, you know, really has been exposed to its own citizens and to the world as well. It's very clear that there is no commitment to human rights or democracy. And of course, you know, in reality, this is nothing new. These are the same governments, the same states that have engaged in the most horrific forms of violence against the victims of their colonialist and imperialist policies abroad, have engaged in horrific violence against workers demanding their rights, against people organizing against racism, against people, you know, fighting for the most basic forms of justice. And this has been expanded, you know, really just intensified at this very broad level, because when there is a conflict between the future of imperialism and Zionism and civil liberties and human rights, well, let's face it, the billionaires and the ruling class are more than happy to chop off the head of human rights, democracy, and civil liberties in order to serve what they view as their interests in the region, which are definitely not in the interests of the masses of people. There is no interest that the average person in the United States has in being involved in genocide in Palestine. There is no interest that a worker in Germany or Italy or Britain has in funding and providing and sending weaponry and sending spy flights to help eliminate Palestinians in Gaza or engage in assassinations and violations in Lebanon or in Yemen. There's no interest that the people have in this. And people have been coming out in unprecedented numbers to express this. And frankly, in combination with the Palestinian resistance and all of the forces of resistance in the region, the imperialist powers saw this as and continue to see this as an existential threat to the maintenance of the Zionist project inside Palestine, because the reality is the Zionist project is artificially implanted, and it relies on the ongoing, unending series of planes of support and military aid in order to maintain that colonial entity in the region in the first place.
And mostly, thank you, Charlotte. Charlotte answered this earlier. I'd like to get your take on it. Why do you think Israel receives this level of protection from Western governments? Governments willing to compromise their own laws and liberties, as you alluded to earlier, attack their own people to protect a regime built on hate, discrimination, apartheid, land theft, ethnic cleansing, occupation, and genocide.
Well, there are a few layers to this. First, Israel is not just another state in Western strategic thinking. It is seen as a key outpost of Western power in the Middle East. It's a heavily armed client state that helps police the region, tests weapon, and also it safeguards the Western economic and geopolitical interests. That's why you see such deep military intelligence and technological cooperation, from arms export to joint surveillance program between the West, where the American Empire heads the West, with the Zionist regime in West Asia. Secondly, there's a powerful network of lobby groups, think tanks, and political donors that have spent years upon years equating any meaningful criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. I mean, you have giant organizations, lobby groups like AIPAC here in the U.S., and that kind of political pressure makes any government willing to bend, if not outright brave. But their own laws and principles avoid being labeled anti-Semitic, even when Palestinians, Jewish anti-Zionists, and human rights experts are clearly saying that opposing apartheid and opposing a genocide is not a hatred for Jews. Third, there's a deep continuity with the war on terror, Islamophobia, Arab racism, and the old colonial logic of civilized versus the uncivilized, and how the British called it just war. They're all being repackaged. Palestinians are cast as a security threat. Israelis as us in that framework, so to speak. And protecting Israel is almost at the cost of your own citizens. Looks to them like defending civilization, and hence you see that repression on American citizens here in the U.S. as well. So when you see a regime built on hate, discrimination, land, ethnic cleansing, and genocide, that's exactly what international law experts and human rights bodies are documenting. What's remarkable is not that Israel is being called out. It's that Western governments are willing to erode their own democracies to stop that truth from getting any kind of power.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And Charlotte, forget the last 70, 80 years. Just the last 2 years alone, we've seen these Western countries protecting Israel to the point where they're violating the rights of, and you very well know it's been documented, academics, including professors and students, activists, advocacy groups. I have a small list here. Journalists, elected officials, actors, producers, musicians, athletes. Now, Charlotte, you very well know, and you've seen it time and again, that these are people that we celebrate in society, people that use their forms to help bring others together, you know, and for Israel, they are being thrown under the bus by their governments. Instead, it's not, I don't know, you could say it's quite remarkable, but really it's just quite pathetic, isn't it?
Well, it's absolutely the case, because the fact is that if you are a person with a conscience today, there is absolutely no way that you can justify aligning yourself with this genocidal, criminal, apartheid, illegitimate entity that has been implanted in Palestine. There's simply no more justification. People cannot just kind of brush it off and say, oh yeah, Israel has a right to exist. That the reality, which is that the Zionist entity is a completely fraudulent, illegitimate entity that is based on colonialism, dispossession, land theft, mass murder and destruction, that everything about the Zionist entity is illegitimate. And as your other guest said so well, there is this deep integration between the security and intelligence services of the Western imperialist powers and the Zionist project. The Zionist project is the testing ground for what we're actually seeing is the same kinds of policies that are being implemented. But one thing it does show is that despite the repression, more and more people are speaking out. People are willing to put their jobs, their careers, their futures on the line. There are, for example, hundreds of tech workers in advanced positions in major corporations like Microsoft and Google and Amazon who have put their jobs on the line or have resigned because they refuse to be part of massive corporations that are continually involved in developing and making even sharper the use of AI and technology to surveil and control and repress and kill Palestinians. And these are people who have, you know, studied hard and worked for years to achieve like a pinnacle of success in their careers. And they're willing to put that all on the line because they don't want to be a part of and be complicit in genocide. And you know, the role of the Western countries is so strong that is the choice. It's complicity or action, and more people are choosing action, and that says a lot.
And Charlotte, I'm going to stay with you for one more question before I go back to Mohsen. Mohsen mentioned how this is a Western outpost, Israel is, and the Zionist project. So as long as that's the case, does that mean that the Zionist entity in Tel Aviv can do whatever it wants with impunity in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Syria, and elsewhere in the region, and anyone who in these Western countries speaks out against the atrocities committed therein basically gets backhanded by their authorities for simply getting in the way?
I mean, that's what the United States and Britain and France and Germany want to achieve. That is the outcome that they want to achieve. They want to impose that impunity. That's why we see absolutely ridiculous things like this UN Security Resolution 2803 coming out of the UN Security Council, even though it is an absolute slap in the face to any concept of international law and to the fundamental principles of the UN Charter, because they want to impose impunity for the Zionist entity. But the fact is that despite the repression, despite the fact that these countries are using their police powers to arrest people, to deport people, to imprison people, to declare our organizations terrorist entities for organizing and speaking out for Palestine, they're not able to change people's minds. People are still willing to go out and disrupt an arms factory. People are still willing to go out and say there has to be an end to this genocide. There has to be an end to this starvation. There has to be an end to these ongoing crimes. So they're not able to achieve their goals. Now, of course, they're also not able to achieve their goals in dismantling, disarming, and destroying the resistance of the people in the region. So it is our responsibility internationally to make it so that they can't achieve the implementation of what they want to see. That despite the repression, we have to organize, to fight back, to stay in the streets, to make it clear that we will not allow these crimes to pass.
Thank you. And Mohsen, get a load of this. Since 2014, U.S. federal and state lawmakers have proposed nearly 300 pieces of legislation aimed at repressing expressions of solidarity with Palestine, with over a quarter of the bills passing into law in 38 states and the federal government. Over 80 bills were proposed in 2023 alone, with some as extreme as a federal bill proposing to expel all Palestinians from the U.S. Mohsen, what part of this sounds legally valid, non-discriminatory, fair, just, or warranted, or has any congruency with the trajectory of the evolution of other laws in our societies these days?
Well, if you step back and look at that number, almost 300 bills since 2014, 300 bills since 2014 have been aimed at restricting expressions of solidarity with Palestine, with over a quarter that have been enacted as law. And it's obvious that this is not about mutually fighting hate. It is about targeting a group's political viewpoint or the nation's political viewpoint. And most of these laws revolve around punishing support for boycotts of Israel, the so-called anti-BDS laws. They condition public contracts, employment, or benefits on a person's willingness to pledge that they will not boycott Israel, especially here in Texas, by the way, where Governor Abbott has been promoting